SDSU President Barry Dunn speaks of his grandfather and a land ethic that guides him to this day. From SDPB, today is Tuesday, April 22nd. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, in honor of Earth Day, we bring you highlights from the Big Sioux Stewardship Summit. Up first, Barry Dunn talks about his grandpa Claude, a cowboy and an American Indian. He tells of the moment he saw the family land ethic play out on the grasslands before his eyes in thousands of blossoming flowers. We'll get to know two photojournalists whose work brings the wild places of South Dakota to a wide audience. Kevin Kiergaard and Greg Latza are with us. Plus, Teacher Talk explores the art of the storyboard in the classroom. That's coming later in the hour. We're broadcasting today from the SDPB Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. For Earth Day this year, we are bringing you highlights from the Big Sioux Stewardship Summit. The summit was held in Sioux Falls last Thursday. It explored environmental and water initiatives. The event was a partnership between the City of Sioux Falls and South Dakota State University. The goal? To connect urban dwellers with rural South Dakotans, especially in the areas of agriculture, conservation, and land management. So first, we are bringing you a personal story about land ethics. As the president of South Dakota State University, Barry Dunn has a huge impact on how South Dakota's ag producers learn to work the land. He learned himself from his grandfather, who was both a cowboy and an American Indian. The two men didn't talk about regenerative ag, conservation, or ecology, but his grandfather's actions showed Barry Dunn all he needed to know.
I'm going to tell a story, a loving story, and hopefully you can see what's behind that, because I think it is the key step for us to take if we're going to change the way we live along this river, however far north, or along any river, or on this beautiful planet. So the story is of my grandfather and a gangly boy, his grandson, and that's me. So Claude Lamoureux was a cowboy and an Indian. As his grandson, growing up in the 1950s and 1960s, that was about the coolest thing ever. As a little boy, I followed him. We spent a lot of time at the ranch, and I followed him as best I could, but he was very, very hard to keep up with. He and my grandma Hattie, seen here, ranch south of Mission, South Dakota, on the Rosebud Indian Reservation, as I mentioned. My boyhood memories are of driving across the ranch in a two-wheel drive green Chevy pickup truck, checking the cattle and the windmills, and making sure all the gates were closed and the fences were tight, Grandpa seeking some reassurance that everything was okay. Many times we rode horses, and from early on I saddled my own. He was never very talkative, but I peppered him with questions to the point of annoyance for him, which I learned by some sharp looks that I needed to be quiet. I have no memory of him tucking me into bed or telling me he loved me or playing games. That was Grandma's job. But on horseback, in his truck, around the supper table, he taught me many, many lessons, most of which I understand much better today than when I was that gangly boy. I know that he was a very good man. I graduated from high school at Christmas time and immediately went to the ranch working full time. It was as a way to get out of that city life. No offense to the city, but I just loved the ranch. And sadly, my grandma died soon after, and I found myself alone on this great big ranch with my grandpa Claude. And he was grieving, and I was trying to grow up, and so it was a poignant time for both of us. By then, his brown skin had even darkened more, and had wrinkled from a hard life defined by scarcity. He wasn't a tall man, but he was still rugged and straight, and his love for the land was very obvious to me. He was a member of the Secundju Lakota He was born on the Rosebud Reservation, south of what is now Winter, into extreme poverty, and just 2 years after the Wounded Knee Massacre on the Pine Ridge, just a few miles west. The stories he told me of growing up were of very, very tough times. Being the oldest, Claude and his brother Howard were sent to a boarding school and academy, which is a tiny community west of Platte. It doesn't exist anymore. But that they sent them there because not to destroy the culture or out of meanness. They sent them there because there wasn't enough to eat. So, academy was across the river from the eastern border of the reservation, which at that time was the Missouri River. It's changed, hasn't it? To get to school in the fall, he and Howard, these are little boys, swam their horses across that river because the river in the fall was low. But in the spring, they had to ferry back across the high water of the Missouri and the ice jams up by Chamberlain and then ride 80 miles home. That was the life on the Rosebud. As a teenager, he rode in the last open range roundups in the Dakotas, clearing the reservations of Texas cattle to open the way for homesteaders. This was chuck wagon life that he described, and I can tell you he didn't like picnics as an adult, as he'd eaten out on the range so much. He described the landscape back then as beautiful, endless grassland, except for an occasional cottonwood grove, which were the sign of water and perhaps some shelter. In 1929, out of financial desperation, my grandpa took grandma and my mother and her brothers to Sioux City, Iowa to find work. He worked in the stockyards, unloading train cars, loads of cattle and hogs at night. Think of that, no light, no electricity, in very, very difficult, brutal conditions, winter, snow, rain, whatever, and he was paid a few cents an hour because it was the only job an Indian could get in Sioux City, Iowa. But he returned to the Rosebud, as many American Indians do, to go home. He returned right after World War II, and he bought a ranch called the Antelope Ranch from C.J. Grossenberg, the well-known Winter implement dealer. He used his Indian preference status and was very entrepreneurial, and he bought abandoned homesteads for literally dollars an acre, and he put together 12,500 contiguous acres and renamed it the L7 Ranch. The L7 was his brand, and he received it from his father, and I still have that. Most ranchers will talk about their prized cattle and their best horses, and Grandpa was very proud of his livestock. He ran a band of mares with a stallion. Again, it was really cool when you're a little guy. But his true love was for the land. During the homestead era, and as part of the homestead contract, farmers had plowed up nearly every flat acre in Todd County that they could find. When they failed during the Dust Bowl, 90% of the homesteaders failed, which is not widely known. They left the land abandoned and scarred and unproductive. Grandpa used to say that weeds were Mother Nature's way of covering her nakedness, and he found the old fields that he had bought covered with weeds and annual grasses. But without understanding the modern concepts of ecological succession, he called those fields go back, the meaning to him that they were trying to go back to their native condition. As I reflect on that, I'm left wondering, where did that understanding of the power of succession, of Mother Nature, to reclaim herself come from? He also knew that planting grasses would hurry the healing, and he worked with the Soil Conservation Service, which is now the NRCS, and he planted literally hundreds, I'd say thousands, but I'm not sure, but hundreds and hundreds of acres of scarred and blowing land back to both introduced as well as native grasses way back in the 1940s and 50s. He planted alfalfa with cool season grasses because he knew it was a natural fertilizer for hay ground, like he knew that purple prairie clover was a natural legume in grasslands. He knew the pastures needed to be properly stocked, and so he was very careful to put just the right number of cattle in each pasture. As beavers had been eliminated from the landscape a century earlier by fur trappers, some of them my ancestors, he understood that building a series of small dams on Antelope Creek, he could raise the water table of the entire valley and increase its productivity and provide water for livestock and wildlife. An interesting phenomena occurred. The beavers came back. But my grandpa didn't use fancy words when he talked about conservation and stewardship. He was very pragmatic, very blunt, usually quiet. He didn't mention his Lakota heritage as part of his values, but upon reflection, they were on clear display. His principles and practices are timeless and elegant. He loved the treeless prairie and taught me to love it. One year, he won a simple small award from the Todd County Conservation District, and he was so proud. An American Indian winning this award, which was unusual at its time, maybe still is. And he was so proud of it, and I was for him. I didn't know at the time that it wasn't a Nobel Prize, because it was in the center of the table around supper time. My lifetime commitment to conservation was inspired by my grandfather and then solidified by education, right, at South Dakota State University. From earning my undergraduate degree in biological sciences way back in 1975 to securing a master's and then a doctorate, I've had many opportunities to learn more about the ecology of our great state and the grassland biome that runs from Canada all the way to northern Mexico and runs from, of course, the Rockies to the Mississippi River. Many years after that eventful spring and summer following my grandma's death, I saw a quote by the famous conservationist Aldo Leopold that reminds me of my grandfather. Leopold said, "The land ethic simply enlarges the boundaries of the community to include soils, water, plants, and animals, or collectively the land. In short, a land ethic changes the role of Homo sapiens from conqueror of the land community to plain member and citizen of it. It implies a respect for the fellow members of the community." For the past dozen years, one of my most rewarding activities at SDSU has been to play a small part in honoring landowners with the South Dakota Leopold Conservation Award. In August of 2020, I spoke about the essence of conservation to the audience that was touring that day and the importance of developing a personal land ethic. I hope you hear this theme, a personal land ethic at a ranch tour of the 2020 Leopold Award winners, the Neil Bean family, who ranched near Veblen, way up on the Coteau, way up by North Dakota. My good friend Neil told the story of how his grandmother, who was homesteading, how his grandmother taught her children a land ethic. They were allowed to pick just a single flower from the roof of their sod house so as not to reduce the seed bank for future flowers. And when earthworms found their way into her sod house, she carried them out, let them live to do the important work that earthworms do. Now, where did that come from in 1900? It's amazing. It's a beautiful story. It warmed my heart, and it reminded me of riding horseback across that treeless prairie with my grandpa. Like Neil's grandmother, my grandfather instilled in me the land ethic that Aldo Leopold was describing. Culturally and geographically, Neil's grandma and my grandpa were worlds apart in South Dakota, let's be honest. But they both taught their children and grandchildren to see the prairie, to understand it, to enjoy it, and actually to cherish it. Aldo Leopold also said, "Teach the student to see the land, understand what they see, and enjoy what they understand. In those terms, my grandfather and Neil's grandmother were very, very successful teachers, weren't they? My grandpa was an old man when he built those dams, planted grass, and stocked his pastures. He didn't live much longer than my grandma because he couldn't live without her. He wasn't around to see or personally benefit from most of the conservation work that he did, to Paul's point about planting a tree. He didn't have to take the responsibility to leave the land better than when he found it, but I am certain that he believed he did. His conservation work and land stewardship were an expression of his values, his ethics. It inspired me then, and it still does, as you can tell today. So even as a young adult, an unobservant, somewhat nerdy, gangly 17-year-old, I clearly remember the aha moment when Grandpa's land ethic clicked with me. So this is 1971, spring of 71, because I could see it with my own eyes. It was during that same pivotal spring I spent with Grandpa after my grandma died. It was a spring morning following some really good rains, which aren't frequent in Todd County, but it was a picture-perfect morning, something you'd expect to see on a Western movie. I was all by myself atop a horse checking fences in an area I had ridden 100 times before. And there it hit me as vividly as Dorothy's world went from black to white, black and white to color when she landed in the Land of Oz. You all know how South Dakota's prairie can be that earthy amber color. That's a picture that I took. A warm and sun-kissed reddish brown with golden undertones, very familiar to us all. In fact, just a sidelight, if you see a green pasture in the spring, it means it was overgrazed the year before. Pastures should look like this. But not that morning. Grandpa Claude's hillsides were lit up. Wildflowers were everywhere in response to those infrequent rains. And it was just amazing. But the experience was much deeper than that. When I looked across the great expanse before me, I could see the difference in land ethics based upon land ownership, and it was on full display. So Grandpa Claude's hills were a quilt of blossoms stitched together by sun, wind, and open sky. I didn't even need the fences to mark the boundaries between landowners. The lack of conservation methods and stewardship and a land ethic contrasted drastically before me. The adjacent lands right next to Grandpa's pasture, they were being farmed for potatoes in Todd County, South Dakota, believe it or not. The adjacent lands looked like a drought-scabbed earth, patchy, uneven gray-brown. They looked worn and diseased. Beyond the beauty, there are important reasons why we all need those flower-covered hills. The journal Science recently reported that butterfly populations in the United States are dropping dramatically, more than a quarter in the last just several decades. But who cares? Really, who does care? We have a butterfly house in Sioux Falls. We can see them there, right? Of course, wrong. In conservation terms, butterflies are what is known as a key species. In other words, the relative health of the ecosystem, or the health of their population, is an excellent indicator of the health of the ecosystem in which they live, and the health of all insects. Conservation, another science journal, reports that 40% of all insect species in America are on a dramatic decline. And what do insects do? They help pollinate crops. They're on the food chain for birds and other animals. They're critically important in that loop that Aldo Leopold described. Because it's an interconnected world, conservation ethics, as Leopold called them, land ethics, are an important link in life's fragile chain, whether we live in cities or in rural settings. As I mentioned, Grandpa wasn't much for talking. but his actions and results spoke volumes to me. His land ethic instilled in me a love and respect for every blade of grass, every butterfly that flutters by, and even an unconventional bird nest, maybe placed where we really don't want it that day. He is the reason I brush worms back into the dirt from the sidewalk, why I pick up litter all over campus, why I recycle everything I possibly can and make somebody tell me they won't take it rather than stop picking it up or stop recycling it. Words can't always teach us values, but actions will. My question for you today is, will our grandchildren or great-grandchildren have the same opportunities? Will they experience the beauty of a swallowtail butterfly in its natural environment, or just view them in a museum of natural history or in a butterfly house? Will they hear a meadowlark sing or marvel at a red-tailed hawk on the hunt flying low across the prairie? I'm concerned, very concerned, as you probably can tell, that they will not. Over the last several decades, native grasslands in South Dakota and the entire grassland biome that I described earlier have dramatically declined in total acres, and with it, biodiversity, whose value we can't possibly measure. Fortunately, we know what to do, don't we? We know the basics of ecology. Everyone in this room does. We know the importance of soil health. We know the principles of good range management. We know that the right tillage systems, we wouldn't have had those terrible accidents on I-29 over the last couple weeks due to dust storms. We know that conservation pays. We have the Leopold conservation winners like Neil and his family, and my grandpa and his grandma to learn from and emulate. We know what to do. We need ethics. We need core values that reflect a love and for the land on which we live and receive our sustenance. But can we muster the common sense and selfless spirit of our grandparents to do that? I'm not sure. So I want to bring this back to the Big Sioux. Why do pastures and rangelands that most of you never see like that, why do they matter in a river's watershed? Well, of course, to Paul's point, they are the sponge. They are the sponge that regenerates an aquifer that you are dependent on for your drinking water. They act as a filter, as Paul described, to clean water. And they impact rivers like the Big Sioux, unless, of course, it's from heavily tilled ground. And that soil that is lost to the Big Sioux and that organic matter probably will never be replaced now, will it? So how the land is treated across a river's watershed impacts all of us. And I was really pleased to hear about the numbers of the work that the city of Sioux Falls has done to change the stream banks along the Big Sioux. But I think we need to commit again, every day, and as a individually and collectively, to have a land ethic that expresses our care and compassion and our responsibility for the land. I'll leave you with another quote. Theodore Roosevelt, one of my favorite presidents, said, "Here is your country. Cherish these natural resources. Cherish the wonders. Cherish the history and romance as a sacred heritage for your children and your children's children." Thank you so much for participating in this important event, the Big Sioux Stewardship Summit. My grandfather and I am proud of you.
That was Barry Dunn. He's president of South Dakota State University. He delivered the morning keynote address at the Big Sioux Stewardship Summit. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We're going to return now to the Big Sioux Stewardship Summit, recorded live at the Holiday Inn in Sioux Falls. I sat down with Keloland Chief Photographer Kevin Kiergaard and photographer Greg Lotza for a conversation about how art flows from nature. Both men began in journalism. Their ability to tell stories on film helped expand their influence beyond beat assignments. Kiergaard is known for bringing South Dakota to CBS Sunday Morning, where their Do Nothing for 2 Minutes features allow viewers to sink into the sights and sounds of a wildlife scene. Latta is a photojournalist, a commercial photographer, and a fine art photographer. You might remember our conversation just a few weeks ago about his latest book, West River.
Greg, do you go out into the field with a plan?
It depends on what to shoot, what I'm trying to get. Yeah. Some of the stories for our books, I know what I'm heading out for, like if it's a branding or if I'm going to follow a rancher around for the day or whatever. But a big chunk of the landscape work that I do is just me getting up before sunrise and trying to get myself into a spot where the sun can rise in a cool area, or if the conditions are right, something cool will happen. And that's what this next series of photos are. This is the Big Sioux up by Lake Ponset. A lot of times when I'm up there, I don't really have, I'm a morning person and I like to see the light in the beginning of the day. So I'll just get up and just start driving somewhere and drive a new direction. You can go to the next one there. This is speckled bellies on a bend up by Lake Ponset, along the Big Sioux. This is at the edge of the Mickelson Marsh, if you're familiar with that up there. Again, just a morning where I just wanted to get out and shoot something, anything. And the next one is, that's a tree full of bald eagles that have been following the migration. That's a really good area up there to see bald eagles because they just follow all the way up and all the way back. And there's a couple of trees in the Mickelson Marsh where they like to roost. And every now and then when there's a full moon, you get a shot like this. And those are all bald eagles, some adults and some juveniles. I'd never counted all of them, but there's probably about 20 of them in that one tree.
All right, let's pause here because we're not going past. There's a tree full of bald eagles that I just happened upon. Is it like Kevin said, you knew they were there for like 3 weeks, or did you get...
I knew from experience that this tree and these trees in this area would have some eagles. I did not know there was going to be this many in the tree.
Yeah.
And
so
ironically,
take me into the scene. Where are you?
Ironically, Kevin has called me before to tell me where eagle nests are at. So we share information.
You told John Miller in First We Imagine, the book, that the worst thing that ever happened to photography was digital photography. Do you still think that's true?
That's a really, really good question. Wow. So I told him that, 10 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
And I probably felt that way back then. And for me personally, digital has made me a worse photographer because I rely so much on the ability to shoot thousands of images in a day and not have to spend any extra money to do that. Whereas everything I used to do was on slide film for the most part, and you know, it was 36 shots a roll and you had to spend money to buy the film and spend money to process it. Whereas now you just have a pack full of cards and I can just blow through all of them and it doesn't cost me any more. So, but what that has meant is that I have lost a little bit of my ability to really wait for the prime moment for something to happen. Instead, I'll just, you know, hit the motor drive and drive my way right through some of these scenes. And I really have to stop myself from doing that because I do it too much. So yes, for me, it's been worse. Competition wise for my business, it's gotten a little bit worse because there's so many people out there with the camera. And you can get a pretty reasonably looking, good looking shot with a digital image and some software. Whereas in the film days, you had to know what you were doing in the camera and make it look great with lighting and everything right as you shot it. So in that regard, I didn't like digital photography when it came, but the ease of use of it and bringing the pictures home or even in my car, putting them on the laptop and seeing what I've got is really a benefit.
Yeah. Was it Jim Brandenburg who took one picture a day?
Yes, and he just passed away last week, sadly.
Yeah.
But I don't mean to be a downer on that, but yeah, he went for a season for 90 days and took one picture a day, and that started his Chasing the Light series.
Mm-hmm. What's made you a better photographer over the years?
Technology.
Yeah.
The young people who work around me, I used to hate them. But now I love them. I love them and I learn from them. And it's made me faster. I have to be faster. Yeah. Or I have to step aside, and I don't want to step aside. So yeah. They've made me better.
Yeah.
They're good. They're so good with their phones. They're so good with everything.
So I took some great pictures when I was out in the Black Hills a couple years ago, and I'm not a photographer. The people I was with were like, no one's going to believe that you took this picture in the Black Hills, because I just happened to be there when everything was green. And it was like the most beautiful thing in the world. How much does luck have to do with, is there such a thing as luck in your work?
Always. I think it's always luck. I don't know who said it. Someone once said, luck is when preparation meets opportunity. And I've lived by that my whole life. I'm always ready. I read a book when I was really young by Dan Rather called The Camera Never Blinks. I live by that too. I always have a camera with me. I'm very lucky because I'm lucky. Just that simple.
I don't believe that. You're very prepared, and I've seen that. But he's right, and Frank.
Say more about Kevin. Just expand on that, Greg, since you know him so well.
Well, he's very prepared and knows where all the wildlife is going to be. And like he said, he watched the otters for days before he actually pulled out a camera, which is a great practice to have. I have nowhere near the patience for that, and I envy that when I see that in somebody else.
So you drive by and you see the Kello truck and you know it's him and you stop. And
I say, what are you shooting, Kevin?
Show us another one of your pictures, Greg. Let's move through the slides.
This is the town of Fairview down along the river down by, well, you guys know where Fairview's at, about 50 miles south of here. Just a cool little town tucked along the river. And again, you can't get a shot like this without a drone to be able to see the river that's buried among those trees like that. Get a good shot of the bridge, the railroad bridge like that, and the town all in the same thing, and then get lucky with a little bit of ground fog in the distance. Drones open up the world for a shot like that that you just couldn't get from the ground. Now, I shot photos from the ground that day too, but there was nothing as dramatic and cool to me as seeing this small town like that. And then I look for patterns too, and the pattern I like in this one is the big curve that the railroad does right through the middle of the frame.
Yeah, so talk about composition and walk people through, if we were your photography class.
I don't really think about like a rule of thirds or stuff so much because I've been doing it for so long. I just shoot until something looks cool, honestly.
That's not bad advice.
I mean, rules have changed. I mean, there are no rules anymore.
No, there's really. No rules. I try to put items into the, the rule of thirds, if you don't know, is if you split a picture up into nine equal parts, at the juncture of those boxes is where you're supposed to put the subject of your photograph to make it more interesting. Or if you put a horizon at one of those lines instead of right through the middle of a picture. And so a picture like this, I just like how the bridge is down to the lower right, the town is in the upper right, and there's just a lot of nature on the other side.
Yeah. Are there rules that you learned that you now have disregarded because they either were bad rules or no longer apply?
I think COVID changed a lot for us because Zoom interviews and things like that were acceptable now really, really changed how we look at things. We just want our information, whether it's pictures or video. And now we're starting to get to the point where everybody's trying to repolish everything and shine it up again and get back to where we were. But it taught us to change, that we have to change, and then sometimes rules can be bent or broken. And I find it now that I'm doing some of my best work by just not doing what I did 25 years ago.
Yeah.
I think a lot of rules have been crushed for bad reasons, and a lot of that is because of your phone, looking at photographs and videos on your phone. You don't get the full effect of it as if you were looking at them on a TV screen or anything bigger than, this. So people shoot differently to account for that, or they try to. If they don't think about that, then they're just not shooting good stuff because I think it makes you shoot tighter and get your subjects bigger because half the time people are looking at it on their phone.
Okay.
And that's a thing with a lot of my clients too, where we're shooting things a lot tighter and knowing that it's just gonna be this big. And for me, it's really, I don't like it. I just like to see photography big. So it's tough. Yeah.
I miss, to your point, on the radio during the pandemic, almost everybody I interviewed was at home in some. And you would hear their babies, their dogs, their grandfather clocks, the birds outside. And I just loved that because that was just in my ears. South Dakota was in my ears with the human voice for 2 years. And now, yeah, someone will apologize. Oh, I should shut the window so it sounds like a studio. I'm like, no, please don't make it sound like a studio. So in some ways, that I will always think of the pandemic, having that one of the lessons in radio, that we can hear a lot more noise and maybe enjoy it. What is the, as journalists, but then also as artists, or you know, former journalist, Greg, what is your responsibility to show something with reality and through a journalistic lens? You know, Kevin, if you're at the falls and there's, you know, a person, you might shoot around them, but if garbage floats in front of you, you're not going to use that shot. When do you interfere to make the picture prettier? And when are you telling the story? You know, an endangered species is another example. You know, you're photographing it. What's the goal here? What's the story that you're trying to tell? So talk a little bit, if you would, about the intersection between those two things and what your fealty is to the truth.
Wow, go ahead.
Well, when I started and I learned in news and working with people like Werner, we were always taught that you never stage things. So when you do a story, you don't stage it. You don't tell a person to stand over there to make it look better. You do what's natural. Be as real as you can, and I keep that all the time. If it's not real, I just won't record it. That's it, that's me, but I won't move the paper. I'll shoot around the paper. Just, that's a good example, but there's always something in the way, and I just find a way to get around it.
Have you seen the watershed change in your careers? Have you watched it? You're watching it very closely. You are close observers of this place. In what ways have you seen it change?
I think a lot around Sioux Falls has changed, especially like I used to take a lot of pictures between Falls Park and the Spillway. And I remember, oh my gosh, 10 years ago, I could spend all day down there and never see anything other than a rat, maybe. Now if you go down there with your camera, I mean, there's river otters, there's mink, there's weasel. I mean, I've seen a lot of things up and down that area. It's cleaned up a lot. And I remember there used to be these big tubes of wastewater that would come out and shoot into the water there, and the water would stink, and they've relocated all those and cleaned it up, and it's obvious if you go down there, there's just a lot more down there now than there used to be. Everything's moved back in instead of moving out as far as wildlife. Yeah, there's some beautiful eagles down there. They can go down there in the wintertime and they sit on the ice and looking at the water open below Spillway, and yeah, it's pretty neat down there. It's not even a park. I mean, it's just open to anybody.
Right. Exactly what you said. I can't add anything more than that. I do try to find places along the the river and anywhere in nature, really, though, that are the same as they might have looked 100 years ago. So I'm not the right person to ask because I've been avoiding people for a long time.
What do you look like? What do you hope it looks like 100 years from now?
Exactly like it does now, or better. And not eroded away, and not, you know, I still want my trees, I want my grasses, I want everything just to look, selfishly, to look very natural and not everything to be farmed completely, even though I'm a farm kid. I love to see CRP pieces around and see some of that, those grasses that might have been there 1,000 years ago.
You can find Kevin Kiergaard's work on Kelloland. You can find Greg Latza at greglatza.com. We'll put some links up on our website to help you find your way. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We'll take a dive into the art of telling a story now. Our Teacher Talk educators break down a filmmaker's tool, storyboards, as a mechanism for teaching nearly any grade or concept. Jackie Wilbur is a faculty member and director of the Center for Student and Professional Services at the University of South Dakota School of Education. She began her career in public schools in 2007. She served as a middle school, a high school teacher, and a public librarian. She is also an experienced registered yoga teacher through Yoga Alliance. Gina Benz is in her 25th year of teaching. She teaches Teacher Pathway and AP English Language at Roosevelt High School in Sioux Falls. She's also on the adjunct faculty at several colleges and universities. She is the recipient of the prestigious Milken Educator Award. Here's our conversation about storyboards. So let's start with what exactly is a storyboard.
Well, I first learned about this on George Lucas's Educational Foundation blog, which is called Edutopia. And so it wasn't surprising to me that they pulled from the world of film and directors. But a storyboard is something that directors and filmmakers use to help convey what is in their mind of imagination for what a film will look like. And they communicate that to their actors and production team. And so storyboards can be used in the classroom for a similar purpose, where you are trying to help your students understand a complex idea or to understand what the plan of action is for the course of a unit, and it's a visual representation of that plan.
All right, so you just draw it out.
Yeah, you can draw it out. You can use any number of creative materials, but yeah, a visual of some kind.
How is this used by filmmakers? And you connected to in the blog a really very cool Steven Spielberg example of just how extensively and perhaps obsessively he uses storyboards.
Storyboards. Yeah. What I really liked about, it's called Spielberg on Storyboarding, for those of you who might be interested, and you can just see it on YouTube. But one of the things I like about that is that it showed over time how his storyboarding evolved. Mm-hmm. So in the beginning, it was sketches of frames or clips or parts of the movie in sequential order that he would use to convey to the actors what the shot would look like. And then over time, computer imaging and things like that evolved to help him more accurately depict what scenes were going to look like. But my understanding, and I obviously do not have a background in film at all, so I'm not pretending to, is that it helps eliminate some of the confusion and then also can expedite the process of filmmaking, because folks can see kind of a frame-by-frame visual representation of what's going to be happening in the work that's being done each day on set.
Yeah, yeah. This is what we're going to get. We need to get this shot, this shot, this shot, this shot. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to waste any film or any time or any resources on things that I know I'm not going to use, because here it is all right there.
Right.
That's the idea behind his storyboarding, which, again, is a little... Is it highly developed?
Yes, it's Steven Spielberg.
It's Steven Spielberg. Okay. Not all of us are Steven Spielberg. Thank goodness. Gina, have you ever heard about this?
No, I'm learning.
This is brand new. Okay.
Yeah, I'm learning. And I'm anxious to see more examples hear about more examples that Jackie gives.
So one of the things I found was interesting, though, Gina, was this idea that if you have a shared vision, everybody understands what we're trying to do, what we're trying to make, what we're trying to accomplish. And that reminded me of you in classroom management. Like if our class has a shared vision of what we're about to take care of, that setting those expectations, making it clear what the accountability is, that's in words what a storyboard is, maybe in images.
Well, and I think you would want to use images in the classroom too, because those go along with the words to make sure that the message is clear. Because you could just put up a schedule, you could just put up an outline, but... Yeah. There's something special about adding the image to it, and probably something that sets a certain tone. I remember that Jackie once taught me how important it is to have things laid out like that for students so that they knew what to expect. And it releases a certain amount of, or eliminates a certain amount of anxiety when you know what's coming.
All right. And let's talk about teachers first, how teachers can use storyboards in the classroom, because one of the things I liked about Spielberg's vision was I have already shot this movie in my mind.
Right.
So as a teacher, I have already taught this class in my mind.
Exactly. I genuinely feel that way. When I watched that documentary with Steven Spielberg, I completely related to this idea of being a director and having everything pre-planned or hopefully envisioned in your mind of the ideal scenario for how things would play out. And so I like the idea of being able to communicate to students, this is the learning journey that we're going on together as a class this year. And I actually did this with one of my courses this semester, where I drew a plot diagram, as English teachers are wont to do, where there's the exposition of a story. And I said, like, here's where you are right now as you've entered into my class this moment in time. And then here is the rising action. These are the various assignments that we'll do as you build your knowledge. And then the peak assignment, kind of the turning point or climax of this story, is going to be on this date or around this time. This is the big assignment we're going to do. And then here's kind of the reflection and falling action as the semester winds down. And so from the beginning of the semester, students had kind of the arc of the class that I had visually represented to them on a plot line, which worked for this class because it's for future English education teachers. So they were pretty familiar with the visual of a plot diagram.
Yeah. You took each semester is its own hero's journey for each.
Exactly.
Each student is the hero of their own story.
Yes.
But I do, before we go on to how students might use storyboards in the classroom and get into these examples that Gina's mentioning, Gina, how important is it for you to be planning and teaching the class before you've taught the class and really thinking about what's going to happen and how the students are going to respond and how much time will it take this to play out, et cetera? How important is that, and how important is it to just, you know, be spontaneous at the same time?
It's one of the most important things because if you allow for too much spontaneity, mm-hmm. and you need to get through 5 concepts in a semester, you'll probably only get through 3.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So you have to have that initial framework in mind, but you don't need to have it so prescripted day to day that you don't allow for it. And spontaneity is good, but also for reteaching and rerouting the direction you're going based on what you see these students already know and what they don't know, because you're constantly diagnosing the students, constantly diagnosing and coming up with a new prescription, a new treatment plan.
I feel like there's an Abbott Elementary where one of the teachers is like making the lesson plan for the whole semester because they got new things that have to be fitted and he's just going to do it perfectly. And it's like 8,000 post-it notes maybe.
Yeah.
And then at the end, it's like, no, Barbara comes in and says, you might want to leave a little room for spontaneity.
Absolutely.
A little room for kids to be kids in your classroom.
Yes. And also just kids are different. I got asked today about my grading practices from one of my teacher pathway students. And she said, well, why did you choose to do it this way? And I said, I have never done it this way before. But this group of students needed something different than my students have needed in previous years.
All right. So are there specific examples before we move on to how students can use storyboards in the classroom to ways that teachers can use storyboarding in the classroom?
So storyboarding really is the telling of a story, and the thing that I like about this concept is that anything could be a story. So from the teacher's perspective, no matter what subject or grade level I'm teaching, I'm just reframing a concept that I need to share with my students in terms of storytelling. So the story of photosynthesis, the story of cell division, the story of the quadratic formula, right? Reframing just facts and figures and things to memorize into the narrative or arc of a story is what storyboarding does. So both teachers and students can do that to either, as the teacher, teach a concept or for students to show their learning of a concept. So rather than writing a paper or, doing a series of problems, students could show that they understand photosynthesis through a storyboard. And say, here are the different images, here's the order that goes in, here's what all the different terminology is. And it's basically a poster, but it's a visual representation of their understanding.
All right. So, and also if I was developing a lesson plan and I was a visual thinker or I wanted to spend the time, I might storyboard my lesson plan and shot by shot think out, well, where are the kids going to be seated at this time? At what point am I going to invite them into a different space? What are they going to be doing to help me get my confidence before I go into the class? It seems like a really good thing for a new teacher especially to have.
I didn't realize how much I was doing that in my mind until I saw this. Yeah. And then, but things like, oh, I'm going to need my desks a certain way. Well, that needs to happen before or after this activity, right? It immediately starts to get your transitions and your organization tightened up because you're visually thinking about where people are moving in the room and what needs to happen before the next thing can take place.
And it can be stick figures.
You don't 100%. Have to be. No, you don't have to be Renoir to make it happen.
You can find this episode and more on SDPB's Teacher Talk. It's a podcast that celebrates teachers and education. Find SDPB's Teacher Talk on your favorite podcast platform. Find the companion blogs on our website, sdpb.org/teachertalk. And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you in the moment. It is produced by Ari Youngeman and Ellen Kester. I'm Lauren Walsh. Thanks for listening.